one of the strange blessings of a life of public ministry in a caring and concerned congregation is the degree to which members of the congregation take liberty to make comment on all manners of things. Art, I like your suit. Thank you. Art, you got a haircut. Art, you've been growing in your beard. What's that all about? And nobody believed me when I told them it would be a sermon illustration. For the text of Psalm 131 has literally rubbed me the wrong way for years. How good and pleasant it is, it says, when brethren live in harmony. It is like fine oil poured on the head that runs down the beard. That doesn't sound good and pleasant at all. And it didn't for years and years. In fact, the whole first decade of my beardedness, I couldn't think of anything more icky than oil poured on my head that ran down my beard onto the collar of my robe. Certainly, the life of fellowship with my brothers and sisters should be better than that. That was until Jeremy Bradley, our youth minister and my mentor in the ways of the profoundly bearded, mentioned to me a product called beard oil. Yeah, see, some of our friends. Don't worry, I'll provide a place for the rest of you to join the sermon in a little while, but for now, I'm just, those of you with beards, we're here. But beard oil, right? And you put it on every day, and you massage it into the beard, and it makes it kind of soft, and the kids like to come up and touch it. But what it also does is it allows you to comb your beard or to straighten it just a little bit so it all pulls in the same direction. No longer are the hairs working at cross purposes. It is a unified whole. And it is good, friends. And it is pleasant. Like brethren living together in unity. It's like the image from Acts 4, isn't it? Where all of the disciples, all of the followers of the way come and they live together in unity and in harmony. They lay their possessions and the proceeds of the property that they have sold at the feet of the disciple, and there is no one in any want or need. How good and pleasant it is when the disciples live together in this kind of unity. Must have been nice. But that's not the church we know today, is it? I mean, a capital campaign is one thing, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a while, but seriously, nobody's selling, bringing all of their goods and laying them here at the beginning. It just doesn't work that way. We're a church that has denominations. We're a church that has come through the culture war. We are a church that has been a locus of strife for generations. And generations of generations. I mean, was it really even this good in the time of the apostles? I don't think so. Paul's letters betray disagreement among the followers who came after Jesus. Even if you turn the page on St. John's letter that was read this morning, you begin to see factions. And frankly, you all are shrewd enough to read between the lines. What reason does one have to say, if we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves and we make him a liar? Only if the person sitting next to you in the pew has been bold enough to say, I have no sin. Even the blissful golden age version of Acts seems to call into the future. Remember how it used to be? The story of Doubting Thomas even suggests that there was dissension among the ranks on the day after Jesus was resurrected. Lots of excellent sermons will talk about what Thomas might have been doing. Canon Razim did a great job this morning. I would encourage you to go back and listen to some of her comments on what Thomas may have been doing as his brothers and sisters in the faith were cowering away. But very few ever wonder why. Why didn't Thomas hang out with the rest of the disciples? Why didn't the rest of the disciples want to go out with Thomas? Why wasn't this a community of trust? On the one hand, they had come through so much. They had shared with one another. They had washed each other's feet. But on the other hand, one had betrayed them, one had denied them, and two had been called out a little earlier for scheming to overtake leadership once Jesus was gone, and well, now Jesus was gone. This was not a model of truth and trust and reconciliation. And now Jesus was gone. Except that he wasn't, right? Some had seen him. In fact, they all had seen him, except Thomas. And so what I want to offer today is an image of this kind of classic story. We hear it this week every year. The story of Doubting Thomas as an interesting model for reconciliation within a community of faith that has such a long track record of putting kind of a veneer of pleasantness on top of it. We wade into the story of Jesus' closest followers today, perhaps at their most vulnerable. Perhaps at the moment where all of this that had gone so well could just go completely wrong. And we hear the unlikely story of a doubting member of the group that I believe we can use as a pattern for reconciliation within the church. What John seems to offer is a powerful but ultimately stylized description of dysfunction within the community of faith. And the character of Thomas, who will go a long way to heal that wound. Some have seen Jesus, others have not. Thomas, both hero and goat of the story, serves as a guide to the necessary path. So let's look at Thomas's response to that. The disciples have said, "We have seen the Lord." Subtext, "You have not." But you need to trust us. The language of us and them pervades the disciples' presentation. Thomas, though, stays with himself. He's evidently read the good system's work, right? Stays with himself. He doesn't say, no, we have not seen the Lord until we all see the Lord. But rather, I will not believe until I see him myself. This will be a journey for Thomas and an invitation for a personal journey of faith for each of us who reads Thomas's story. So what is it that Thomas seeks? I will not believe, he says, until I see the marks of the nails in his hand and put my hand into the mark in his side. Thomas doesn't seek the testimony of three or four or even a dozen others. He doesn't bring in outside experts. He doesn't ask for a consensus opinion. Rather, what Thomas needs and what he is willing to say is the real presence of Christ. To be in the physical presence of his risen Lord. And to have his own opportunity for an experience of faith. And when that is granted him, Thomas follows all the way to the end by reaching out in his own vulnerability to touch the very woundedness of God. It would have been enough, we might think, for Thomas simply to have seen Jesus there, realized the strangeness of his request, suffered a little bit more shame, and fallen down and said, "My Lord and my God." But what does he do? He reaches out and he touches Jesus. He allows Jesus to meet his very personal, very private, very vulnerable need. And he does so by reaching into the very vulnerability of God. Putting his fingers in the marks in his hands. Touching the scar in the side of Jesus. Friends, too often as we process this ministry of reconciliation, this ministry that has been given to us, modeled to us by Jesus' own reconciliation between the fallen humanity and the God that created him, too often we are willing only to touch the very veneer of that, to speak as a group only. To ignore our own needs and our own brokenness, and to fall just a fraction short of reaching out in that real presence to touch the God who has so desired to be with us that he has even become one of us. Today, friends, I think we are called to be more like Thomas. To seek out with every fiber of our being Jesus' real presence among us. To not only desire it, but to ask for it as a pathway to our own healing. And then, whenever and wherever Jesus is made manifest to us, to go ahead and take that final step to reach out and to touch him. And in doing so, to find our own healing and our own belief. Friends, it is only through our healing, and it is only through our belief that we will become reconciled to God. And it is only through our own healing, and only through our own belief that we will become reconciled to God. Amen.